And hello, everyone. Welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Candace LePage.
And I want to welcome our new listeners, and by that I mean the new young people who are clogging up campus with their youth and...
Clogging it up. It's exciting. There were so many blue people on campus today. I don't know why, but there they were.
Smurfs?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
All right.
It's fun. It brings fun to the city.
Yeah, it does. Joking aside, it does.
Yeah.
And it's nice to have the UC open on a weekend now.
I know. You can actually get a beverage.
That's what we really like. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans, and we are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the Canadian horror thriller, The Black Coat's Daughter. That's in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to take a break from some of the regular news we cover, and we're going to revel a bit in the fall season, and not just because it's going to be cooler, which I know me and Candace agree on as a priority as we look forward to the fall. But it's also that time of year when I think people think of Hollywood getting more serious or less blockbustery.
Oh, do they? Not according to my list.
Oh, okay. Awesome. But you're right. That is changing. You know, there are films
that come out in February now that are, you know,
that's
Oscar
true.
Contenders. So the whole world's gone topsy-turvy.
Cats and dogs living together. Mass hysteria. Okay, so we each crafted a top five. I sort of figured where your ideas would be at, mm-hmm. so I kind of tiptoe around them on my list. But let's start with our first pick, and we'll start with you.
How are we doing this? Any order?
Any
top
order you
one?
Like.
Okay, so I think I'll go by when they come out.
All
How
right.
does that sound?
That's
so,
perfectly reasonable.
Which I think makes next week or the following week pretty exciting for me because The Predator comes
out. Oh, yes,
out.
yes.
Yes, which is, I am excited about it. I did see a trailer or two over the summer, which is awesome. Shane Black, of course, is doing it, mm-hmm. Previously of Predator.
Yes, he was one of the
actors in the original Predator. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know, I'm excited. It looks... I have an immense amount of love for Aliens, Predator, and Aliens versus Predator.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, I've pretty much watched it all, and I've enjoyed it all. And sometimes, you know, I will take a more artistic look and say that, you know, some of the films are not very good. There are a lot, particularly in the Aliens franchise, that have come in a little subpar. Predator, I feel like Predator gets away with subpar films a little bit more for some reason.
Well, it was
probably because it was never like it was an action. Like it was straight up, that first Predator film was straight up action.
Cheesy B movie.
Sci-fi horror sort of thing.
Yeah.
Nobody expected anything else of any of the other future films.
Yeah. It was Commando with an alien in it, which I think you're right. I like Predators more than most people. I thought that was enjoyable.
Yeah, I did enjoy it. I didn't get a chance to see it in the theater, and so it was one of those ones that I kind of ended up watching later on, and I haven't seen it really enough times to have it be have a really strong take on it, but I certainly enjoyed it. And I mean, Adrian Brody.
Yeah, he was more badass in that than
I
you
know,
would have thought.
Right?
It was like they hired Adrian Brody, and I was like, Adrian Brody's gonna fight
that
Predator.
That tall, lanky dude.
Yeah,
really.
But no, he showed up. That was great. My first choice is The Front Runner. It is the appropriately a political movie. It is directed by Jason Reitman, and he co-wrote it with Matt Boy, and it's based on Boy's book, All the Truth is Out, this week, and the week politics turned tabloid, and it's about the 1988 failed presidential run of Gary Hart, who was a Colorado senator, and it came out that... it's weird. It's not like there was nothing. It's not like the Clinton scandal. It's not like the proto Clinton scandal. It was like a lot of word of mouth that he was a womanizer and that he was cheating on his wife. and a picture was taken as sort of all this was breaking. A picture was taken of him with a young woman who was a staffer on his campaign.
Remember more innocent times when those sorts of things would preclude you from high office?
Right. Inferences were made, although I don't think anything was ever proven that they were in an inappropriate relationship. Mm-hmm. It's just like they got caught hugging. And because he was a powerful man and she was a young lady, it was, you know, people put one and one together, unfortunately, or... You know,
also, I mean, remember those worst times when simply having a relationship with a person of another sex was the end of the world.
Well, yeah. And I'm thinking that's in his like I'm leaving the he quit the race a couple of weeks after all this started. And he quoted or paraphrased Thomas Jefferson and Gary Hart. He said, I'm trembling for my country when I think we may, in fact, get the kind of leaders we deserve. And so that's really kind of prescient 30 years later.
Yeah.
But Hugh Jackman's in this. He plays Gary Hart. Mm-hmm. I feel like this is Hugh Jackman saying, give me an Oscar already. But he's...
Yeah, that guy is so talented.
Yeah, he deserves it. I mean, he's kind of like the male Kate Winslet now where he does stuff.
I'm following.
Typically win somebody an Oscar, but other people sort of get in his way. I feel The Greatest Showman was that and Les Miserables was that. But, I mean, it's a true story. It's Jason Reitman. So, you know, this is like his first sort of like real political movie since Thank You for Smoking. So Vera Farmiga, J.K. Simmons co-star. So it should be
every
very,
movie
very good.
It's so much better when J.K. Simmons is in it.
Oh, yeah. And the show he did, Counterpart, is really good, where he plays two different J.K. Simmonses.
Oh, yeah. Simmons-I?
Simmons-I.
Simi? I don't know. Simi.
Okay. You're number two.
My number two, I have mentioned this previously when we talked about TIFF films, because A Star is Born, something I have been looking forward to for a while. I just feel like there's a lot of things that I really like that are all coming together. So one is Bradley Cooper, who I've always really, really liked as an actor and just as an attractive specimen of the male species. But I'm excited because this is...
They should put that on the movie poster.
his first directorial.
Yes.
Which,
yes,
it is. I, you know, that always interests me to see how people who have been in the world for a while turn around and try doing it from a different point of view. Mm-hmm. I think with many people it has worked really well, and I hope that for Bradley Cooper it goes really well too. Lady Gaga, also someone that I have really always liked as a performer, as a songwriter, just as a being.
Personality.
Yeah, yeah. So what I think is really exciting about this is I think that it's going to make a lot of people realize that Lady Gaga is not just a piece of performance art.
Yeah.
Like, she actually is a real person with real talents. And then I just, you know, I grew up in the early 80s with a mom who is from the 70s. And man, that original Kris Kristofferson, Barbra Streisand, A Star is Born was on a lot at our house. I know that soundtrack like inside and out. So I'm really excited to see. And the reality is that was in itself a remake of one from the 50s too, which had really, you know, done such a great job of making it of its time, you know, again, by having Kris Kristofferson, who is, you know, essentially playing himself in a way. So I'm excited to see how they do that again, how they take this same sort of story and re-envision it and put it really solidly in the whatever we're calling this decade now.
Yeah, that's a good question. We need a name for the decade.
Yeah, the tens.
I mean, obviously, when you watch the trailer, Bradley Cooper is channeling Kris Kristofferson pretty
hard.
And
I'm okay with that.
Yeah, no, it works. It's working for him. And I like that trailer a lot. You know, it's not kind of like the inner world style of feeding it to you. You get a very good idea of what the tone and what the characters are about. And you know, Bradley Cooper, he's a pretty boy for sure, but I mean, he's also serious about the craft.
He's a really good actor
in the actor studio, so he's you know, he's more than a pretty face. So, and it's a passion project for him. So, I mean, those are always interesting to watch because they either rise to the occasion or they crash and burn. But it's definitely not boring. My number two is Widows, which is the new Steve McQueen film, and it's based on the book by Gillian Flynn, who people remember from Gone Girl, that was based on her book, and Sharp Objects was based on her book. And Steve McQueen, of course, 12 Years a Slave, Hunger, Shame.
Just a few little throwaway films he's made.
Completely light and fluffy.
Yeah.
And this is like his first film since 12 Years a Slave. Mm. He was working on an HBO project that seemed to crash and burn. But like, oh, the cast on this. You have Viola Davis. You have Elizabeth Debicki, Michelle Rodriguez, Colin Farrell, Daniel Kaluuya, Carrie Coon, Liam Neeson, John Berthel, Robert Duvall, an actor from Atlanta. He plays Paperboy in Atlanta, Brian T. Henry. He's the bad guy, but like Viola Davis.
Spoiler alert.
It's in the trailer. I don't consider things in the trailer spoilers, within reason. But, you know, Viola Davis is so fierce. I feel like she's like the way she performed in like Suicide Squad is like the cutthroat, like cold-blooded, like general woman. I feel it gets better used in that trailer than it does in the entirety of Suicide Squad. It does remind me a bit of Set It Off, which was the F. Garrett Gray movie, which was about Jada Pinkett Smith and Queen Latifah as bank robbers.
Yes.
I mean, it's weird that, I mean, because that was 20 years ago that movie came out. So it's weird
to
come back.
Was it?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, 1998.
Whoa.
So it's funny that, you know, 20 years later we get there's Michelle Rodriguez is Latina and Elizabeth Debicki's white. But, you know, to be led by Viola Davis, who is such a presence no matter what she's doing, if she's like How to Get Away with Murder, where it's all about power suits and stuff, or whether it's like this where she's like leading women into bank robberies. It's you know, she's always a powerhouse, and I look forward to this. And of course, you know, it's Steve McQueen, so it's gonna have to try really hard to fail.
And can we just take a second to thank the world for giving us so many women criminal films lately in every genre, right? Like, we've gotten the like broad comedy, we've gotten the sort of like heist film, we're getting the more you know, thriller type thing. Like, we're getting it in every genre of film, so it's refreshing.
Women can be bad. Who would have guessed?
I know, for a myriad reasons.
Yes. Anyway, number three.
All right. I feel like I don't entirely remember my last three. I feel like they either come, a couple of them come at the same weeks or whatever. But so Bad Times at the El Royale.
Ooh, yes, that's my number. That's one of mine.
Yeah. I felt like that one would probably definitely cross both of ours. I mean, I couldn't tell you what this film is about from the trailer, and I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. It looks like a pastiche of like pulp.
Yeah,
you know,
it's very pulpy.
Oh, it's just great. And so Drew Goddard is the writer and director, I think. Drew Goddard, I love. I have loved him since the very first time he ever did anything in my sphere of influence, which was a script for Buffy the Vampire Slayer in the seventh season. It was like the last season. It just sort of came out of nowhere. And it just was like, this is so smart. Like, this person knows every single character. He knows all of the arcs over 7 years. He's closing loopholes that have been left open forever, or at least bringing them back to say, hey, remember this? Like, it's just, it was so, so smart. And I was like, wow, this guy is really, really good. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you know, I know he went on to do the Cabin in the Woods.
Yep.
Which was... had its issues being shelved for so long, but again,
nothing to do with the movie. It was purely because MGM had financial issues.
But again, right? So like self-referential, like very inside, very self-aware, totally. You know, this is clearly a person who really loves the thing that he's writing about, and can both make fun of it and show love for it at the same time, which is like, I just see it's just splashy with pulp, this trailer. And I mean, the actors, of course, are amazing, like Jeff Bridges and Chris Hemsworth,
John Hamm.
Thank you, John Hamm.
Dakota Johnson's in it too, who I like a lot. Even in the 50 Shades films, I think she rises above the material. And then there's it shares an actress with Widows, Cynthia Erivo, who is probably best known for her stage work. Like, Widows and Bad Times at El Royale are like her first movies ever. Because she's, I think she won a Tony for the revival of The Color Purple on Broadway. So she's a very, very good actress. And she definitely stands out in one of those El Royale trailers because she's singing the an Isley Brothers song.
Yes.
In it. And it's really, really kind of sets like the dreary tone in the latter half of the trailer.
Yeah. So I don't know. I'm excited. I am going to be getting a lot of popcorn and just expecting to be awash in pulpy, neon-y grit.
They are selling this movie better than they sold Cabin in the Woods.
Oh,
which I understand why you would have a hard time marketing Cabin in the Woods. But
yes, since basically in the first 5 minutes, the film gives away the entire premise.
Right. And and part of the fun is sort of going in not knowing what to expect. Mm-hmm. And when Richard Jenkins and Bradley Whitford become sort of the extant protagonists of the film for the most part versus like all the pretty young people like Chris Hemsworth. I think that'll be like because Chris Hemsworth has proven he can't really do much wrong.
No, he seems to be good, again, similar, right? Good at every genre. His comedy chops are great. Obviously, he's got the action superhero thing with Thor.
He can work out, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, to go back to Drew Goddard, this is somebody who, he started on Buffy. Mm-hmm. I think he went on to Angel after that. But then he worked on Alias and Lost, or Lost and Alias.
Yeah.
So, he's worked for Joss Whedon, and then he worked for J.J. Abrams. So he's kind of, like, learned from both the masters in terms of, like how you subvert the genre. Mm-hmm. So when we get to Cabin in the Woods, it's not necessarily surprising that he's able to, you know, sort of manipulate things and create a compelling story while still sort of being able to subvert the genre and you know, subvert the tropes. And I'm wondering, first of all, what's he subverting in El Royale? Because what it seems like when you kind of first see it, it's like, oh, here we go. This seems like one of those late 90s Tarantino ripoffs.
Yeah.
Where it's like, we get a bunch of bad people together and they talk really fast. And that's basically what Tarantino does.
Yeah, and with a soundtrack.
With a soundtrack, basically. But when it comes up on screen, it's from Drew Goddard, who did Cabin in the Woods, but he also wrote The Martian and Cloverfield as well.
Right.
That then, you know, this is not going to be what you expect.
Yeah.
Or at least it's not going to deliver what you expect. So I'm very interested in seeing what happens. Because when I first saw the trailer, and I saw it on the big screen first, I was like, what is this? And when can I see it?
Yes, I know. How long? How many days before this?
How many sleeps? and I love John Hamm in it because John Hamm's been doing a thing where he's like, purposefully not doing like Don Draper stuff.
Yeah.
So this, you know, with this loud Don Cherry-ish jacket he's wearing, it seems like he's at it again. So, you know, it's interesting performers and interesting filmmakers. So I'm excited too.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go to your number four.
All right. Well, since we're going in order of when they're released, my number four is the number one movie I'm waiting for. All year I've been waiting for Halloween.
Oh,
yes. 2018 version. So John Carpenter is back as a writer, along with some other people. But so he is involved in this. Jamie Lee Curtis is back, which is great. And I just love Jamie Lee Curtis, period. She's always great and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But recently, she's been doing such great work with Scream Queens, which is the Ryan Murphy television show, and which I think a lot of people didn't pay much attention to. I loved it.
In Ryan Murphy's defense, he has like 1,200 TV shows.
Tell me about it. But yeah, so this is the guy who does Glee and American Horror Story. So just take both of those, put them together, and you have Scream Queens. Like, that's really it. He really gets that, like, really broad comedy, like, what the heck is going on, mm-hmm. sort of acting style, and then the kind of horror-ness of it. So I think they did three seasons, but in one of the seasons, so Jamie Lee Curtis is the head of this school. In one of the seasons, she actually reenacted the psycho shower scene, which of course her mother Janet Leigh was in.
Yeah.
So I think that she's really been, because she's been doing that, I think she's really sort of re-embracing her history as a scream queen, right? as this person. So I was very excited to hear that she was, you know, going to be involved in a new Halloween film. Because I just want to see her in anything. Mm-hmm. And I want to see her and John Carpenter together. And I think that so many years later, there's somewhere interesting they can go with that.
Mm-hmm.
What I understand is that it's going to just sort of pretend that nothing has happened since the first film.
Yes.
So even though Halloween 2 did sort of continue Jamie Lee Curtis's character, Laurie Strode, it continued
it's
her story.
Written by Carpenter.
Yeah. They're just going to pretend that wasn't actually the continuation. And
right, because if I remember correctly, that was like the whole thing about Laurie Strode being Michael Myers' sister was something that was forced upon.
Yeah, it was
Carpenter.
Not in the first film.
Yeah.
Wasn't really planned to be something, but in the second film, they sort of,
Yeah, that was like Arskind or something saying like, oh, there needs to be stakes or like one of those Hollywood notes thing you get.
Yeah, and so with H2O, when that, and so again, Jamie Lee Curtis had come back for that, they really did play up that sibling part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think now, you know, she's interested in coming back for a different alternate way that the Laurie Strode story could have ended.
Right.
There's
more alternate realities in the Halloween franchise than Star Trek at this point.
And I'm fine with it. I'm totally fine with it. It doesn't make H2O not as fun of a movie as it was.
No, it's a lot of fun. Some of LL Cool J's best work. I love LL Cool J.
And Josh Hartnett.
That was the
Michelle
start.
Michelle Williams.
Yeah, no, there are great people in that, no doubt.
Yeah.
No doubt. My number four is also kind of a horror remake. Don't call it a remake. It is Suspiria.
I thought about putting that one on the list.
But it is from Call Me By Your Name director, and I don't want to muddle it up. It's Luca Guadagnino.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said it's not a remake. It's kind of like a tribute to the feelings that seeing the original Suspiria conjured up in him. But
And this is being written by daughter of original Suspiria writer.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So can't get her name.
Argento.
Yeah. Yep. I'm crossing my,
Argento Jr.
Thank you. Yeah.
Sure. No, it's interesting all around. Plus, the actress, Jessica Harper, who is the star of the original Suspiria, is back in it as a different character, but it's got Tilda Swinton, who may or may not be playing two characters because there's this, like, I don't know, they're playing this sort of funny game where there's an old man character who is played by Lutz Ibenstrick, who is supposed to be like an actual real, because the director is so dedicated to realism, he wanted a real old man psychiatrist in the part, but apparently it's Tilda Swinton under old man makeup. But it's also got Dakota Johnson in it, and also Chloe Grace Moretz, and the music is by Tom York of Radiohead.
It's a little madness on screen.
There's a little madness, and if you've seen the trailer at all, like just the trailer doesn't do anything sort of gross or you know, sort of anything explicit like that. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's like visually upsetting. Like some of the quick cuts you see of the dancers like in contortion, it's just like what is going on?
Yeah.
And I'm freaked out just watching this, and I don't know if I want to go to a darkened theater and watch this.
Yeah.
But
I will admit, even though I probably wear the horror crown here in this, you know, gang of this, four or five of us.
Yeah, yeah.
I have never actually seen the original Suspiria.
Mm-hmm.
And every once in a while I think, I'm going to watch this. But then it's always like I want to really just watch it and be completely engrossed in it.
Yes.
So I feel like I feel like when the new one comes out, that's going to be a perfect time to do like, okay, I am going to turn off all the lights at home and I'm going to watch the original.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll go to the theater and watch the remake. Yeah. Or the reimagining.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't want to offend anyway. That brings us to number five.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know if I'm excited to see this film or if I'm dreading seeing this film.
Okay.
But it is certainly on my list, and that is the Queen biopic Bohemian Rhapsody. That's
yes,
actually what they're calling
that's
it.
That's what it's called.
I mean, I'm so conflicted. So I love Queen. Freddie Mercury, I think, was an amazing person, amazing artist on so many levels, chose to live life to the fullest the way that he needed to,
mm-hmm.
At a time when that was still not particularly, that open, especially as a Persian, which... is like seriously frowned on,
especially at that time when
yeah.
the revolution was
yeah
in
like
progress.
There's just so many things that I think he's someone to really look up to say, you know what, he just did it. He came out and mm-hmm. said, no, this is who I am, and now I'm gonna be me.
Mm-hmm.
Also an amazing artist. So I think that it's been a long time coming for a biopic about Freddie Mercury. I'm really surprised it hasn't happened
yeah.
before, because he's such a figure and he has such an interesting story. But there's just been so much about this film that it feels like it's gone off the rails.
Right.
You know, there's Bryan Singer's involvement, which is problematic.
Mm-hmm.
Bryan Singer is a gay man, so it sort of makes sense in some ways, because probably he has different feelings about Freddie Mercury than maybe I would.
Right.
But then there's also, you know, Bryan Singer does still have some sort of unresolved at, yes,
yeah.
issues,
yeah.
Which are a problem. And then there's the fact that we had two different actors, like originally Sacha Baron Cohen was going to play Freddie Mercury, and now it's Rami Malek. Is that
yes.
how you say his name?
Mr. Robot.
Yeah. So it's just sort of like, you know, how many... There's just questions. I have questions. And so I want to see it. I also don't want to look forward to it too much, because if it does not work out very well...
Yeah.
I don't wanna, yeah. You know, yeah.
It almost made the cut on my list, but, you know, I have some of the same reservations. Although I believe in Rami Malek, because mm-hmm. I think that performance will be really, really good.
Yeah.
But, yeah, the movie could be a mess because of all the behind-the-scenes stuff. My number five is a documentary, Sharkwater Extinction. It's the last film by Rob Stewart, who died in the process of diving while making the film. And so it was completed by his foundation, so it's kind of a tribute to him. But it's also a sequel to I think it was 2006 documentary Sharkwater, which he's talking about protecting sharks and their place in the ecosystem and the exploitation of shark materials by different countries around the world. And the trailer of this sort of makes it like Mission Impossible kind of, like, it's, you sense that there's may have been like real danger in him making this, in terms of like sort of the forces he was putting to the test, the industry of, you know, trading shark products, and not just like shark fin soup, but mm-hmm. it goes so much larger than that. Now, that's not to imply that there was some sort of conspiracy, but of course, I mean, accidents happen when you're diving, which is why mm-hmm. you have to be trained and certified. But I mean, it's. I think the first Sharkwater film was so great, and I interviewed him at the time, and so and really heard his passion for it, mm-hmm. and so this was a deeply personal issue for him, and I'm glad they took the time and effort and energy to finish this, because I can't think of a better tribute to his life and work. And if it gets, you know, we kill fewer sharks because of it, I think it's all worthwhile, and I think Rob Stewart would agree it's mm-hmm. worthwhile. That's a
yeah.
bummer.
There's no reason to kill sharks.
No, there really isn't.
Not even if they're the megalodon.
Well,
maybe especially if they're the megalodon.
Well, if you see how The Meg ends, there's kind of a tribute to regular size sharks and the heroism of regular size sharks in the wake of predators, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. The less we talk about The Meg, I'm fine with. It's we're going to take a break here and then come back with our review of The Black Coat's Daughter. We're going to put you in a mood for it being September, though, and play a little classic here. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. That was a clip from The Black Coat's Daughter. It is the new film from Oz Perkins, and it stars Lucy Boynton, Kieran Shipka, James Remar, Lauren Holly, and Emma Roberts. I feel chills. And, you know, not just because the movie's set in winter, but that movie has The Black Coat's Daughter, I mean, has an entire sense of foreboding to it from beginning to end. And I didn't know anything about this movie before I clicked play. Mm-hmm. And I was not disappointed. It is a slow burn, though.
Yes.
It is a slow burn.
To be fair, all I knew about it, because I did recommend it, so all I knew about it was I do listen to a variety of horror film podcasts. And I didn't listen to any that actually reviewed it because I had heard a number of them just randomly say, oh, and also I saw The Black Coat's Daughter and that film has really stuck with me. Mm-hmm. And so when one of the films did review it, I actually skipped that episode because I thought, I want to see this film. So that's why I recommended it, since I don't know how many of you have looked at the movie listings this week, but it's a little dry.
Yes. Spoiler alert for the Operation finale. They get Eichmann.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Yeah, but so Black Coat's Daughter actually came out earlier this year, 2018, in sort of the February, you know.
Yes.
It was just kind of quietly released. I'm not sure if it even really had any sort of theatrical release or if it was just sort of put out VOD.
Yeah, it was part of Midnight Madness in 2015. Mm-hmm.
Because it's actually it was filmed a while ago. So Osgood Perkins, son of Anthony Perkins, this is actually his first film that he wrote and direct. Mm-hmm. But we're seeing it after I've already watched his second film, which was, the name of the film on Netflix, I Am the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House or That Lives in the Walls, or
I'll look it
lives
up
here,
going.
Or something like that. So I had already seen one of his films, which, you know, I similarly on Netflix, it just sort of appeared, and I thought, well, this looks interesting. It's kind of a haunting, and it was It's a real similar, you know, to The Black Coat's Daughter, just this, as you say, like, foreboding.
Yeah.
Slow burn. Like, and certainly things happen in this film. It's not, sometimes you get sort of a slow burn and then you're just like, okay, is anything ever going to happen? So things do happen eventually in this film, and they happen in a pretty tight time frame.
Yeah.
Towards the end of the film. But even still, what I loved about it is at the end, it was still sort of like, okay, what just happened here? What did I just watch? What did I just go through with these characters, which was great.
It's a full circle at the end, which is, I went on YouTube after I watched it, and I was looking up the clips and stuff to get ready for the show today. There was the ending of Black Coat's Daughter explained. I was like,
yeah.
Really? Does it need explained? It's not that complicated. I don't want to get into the ending, but I felt a bit bizarre that I think the movie, when you get to the end of the movie, you see, and you look back and you see exactly how it all unfolded out, even like the very first scene.
Yes.
Which is a dream sequence, but actually tells you.
Yeah.
informs in the, you know, what's going on in the rest of the film.
Yeah, well, and what is great about this film is that you don't really ever know. There are times when you're like, is this a dream sequence? Was that dream sequence actually a dream, or was it a memory, or is it actually happening? There are really no visual cues to let you know that what you're seeing at this moment, even necessarily, you know, from which character you're sort of seeing it either. So it's, I don't want to say confusing, but it's, I mean, you're really in it with them. You're just as like, what's going on around here?
Yeah. And it, I mean, I mean, it's a Canadian film, so there wasn't obviously money for like sets and things. So everything, all the locations are very real. So you feel like this is taking place somewhere real because they were filming in some place. Even the restaurant, which James Remar is having dinner with Emma Roberts. It looks like one of the, like a million roadside diners along the roads in eastern Ontario. And interestingly, filmed in Kentville, this movie, where
University of Guelph campus.
So there's it's so nice when we can have a connection like this.
Yeah.
Oh, Osgood Perkins' other film is I Am the Pretty Things That Live in the House.
In the House, okay.
So there we go. I didn't actually know about his connection to Anthony Perkins, but he actually played young Norman Bates in Psycho 2.
You know, I just picked up Psycho 2, 3, and 4 as a $9.99 deal, so I'm sure
I'm surprised. It was $9.99?
Yeah, it was that much. It might have actually been $5.99 now that I think about it.
But getting back to Black Coat's Daughter, it's like a lot of it is... a lot of it's performance based because there's not much in the way of special effects, if there are any at all. A lot of it's just very much like it's almost like Dogma 95 in terms of using the light that's available. A lot of low light situations and dark hallways. And it looks like this, like some scenes, like the scenes in the one girl's dorm room. It's like it's being lit up by just the lamps in the room.
Yes, and I actually understand that because I did watch Oz Perkins has done a commentary for the film, and so it sort of gathered a bunch of it. And yes, most of the lighting was just the actual light available. In the room.
Yeah.
So from the windows.
So I mean, it's very real, and then. The performances too, Kieran and Shipka, who people, well, speaking of Dawn Draper, was she played Sally Draper in Mad Men.
Yeah.
There's something so unsettling about her. She's a freshman named Catherine. And she's, it takes place at an old girls' Catholic boarding school.
Yeah.
So you know some bad stuff's going to go down. Yeah. But
there could be any number of things.
So she plays Kat, and one of the first scenes you see her in, she's with the headmaster, and she's sort of looking she's not looking at him, she's looking off to the right of him, and she's like got this like sort of creepy little grin on her face, and you're thinking to yourself, is she just like like a nervous like freshman girl who's like maybe away from home for the first time, or like what's her story, or is she like nuts and we're going to be watching her
go and so nuts. I will say that I actually felt when I saw that, I felt like, oh, does she have like a crush on the headmaster? Like,
I thought
that's
that
how
too.
I read it.
Yeah.
But it is interesting. Once you go, like, this is definitely the type of film that has rewatch value, because then you go back and you go, oh. Because even after, you know, at the end, you're sort of like, okay, so when did possession happen?
Yes.
Yes. Right?
Yes.
At what point did things start going like weird for these girls, before we even stepped in, when we stepped in, after, like, and you don't really know, we don't really know how much of this is the horror of it, and how much of those little weird quirks that each of the girls has is actually just their, you know, maybe strict upbringing or whatever circumstances they're in.
It's, yeah, that leaves, it leaves it's that part of it unanswered. And, you know, I think there are little signs that perhaps she arrived at that school. You know, there's like, in conversation with the headmaster, he's talking about how she's like settling and how she's getting ready for this talent show competition where she's going to sing, and how that's going. So it's like, it's almost like he's giving her some special attention because she's like a special ed case almost.
Yeah.
But it's, I mean, that's, the performance is great, and, and she's really great. And there are lines where she's talking to Rose, and they're both kind of, Rose and Kat are both left at the school.
Yep.
Everyone else goes on vacation, so they're, for various reasons, Kat's parents haven't arrived. Rose has told her parents not to come and pick her up because she's meeting a boy. And there's, when Rose is getting ready to go out, and Kat says to her, "You smell pretty." The first time you can believe that something like young girl who looking up to an upperclassman was like, because, you know, you're so beautiful and popular.
Yep. I want to be like
you. I want to be like you. And then later when she says it, it is so creepy.
Yes.
It's like, I want to take off your skin and wear it because you smell good. Creepy.
Yep.
And that's like, that's,
and like
the midpoint of the film.
Her delivery is no different. Like, it's
no
just
different,
it's amazing.
At all.
It's such an amazing piece of like timing. Really, like a lot of it's just like, yeah, the awkward, like, she says nothing.
Yeah.
And then that's what she says, and it's like, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's that point where Rose goes back to her room and puts the
locks the door. Yeah.
And I was like, you know what, Rose? I think you're onto something.
Yes, that's pretty smart. Yeah.
And Lucy Boynton plays Rose, who, and she's really good. The first time we see her, she's getting her class picture taken, and she comes in. She sits down and has this big smile on her face, and you think she's this beautiful girl, not a care in the world. And then immediately,
most popular girl in school, probably.
She has it going on. And then it smash cuts, and just to her like being dour and being worried that she's pregnant because her period's late.
Yeah.
And we don't really see that lightness come back again until she, later on, where she goes to the bathroom and she has her period. This just like wonderful relief on her face.
Yeah.
And, but the way, like, that performance, I like a lot, because Boynton's able to just sort of turn it on or off. And, I mean, she's really good. Both these young women are very, very good.
Yeah. And she very much, like, there are some scenes before all the other students go away where they do interact with some of the other students. And, you know, she seems like the type of girl who kind of wants to pretend that she's the bad girl, but obviously she's not, like, obviously she is worried about this, right? But she's like passing it off like,
well, they're all smoking cigarettes too, which I didn't think was still like that big of a mark of, I mean, it depends on when this takes place too,
and that's the thing, it's questionable, like there's nothing, you know, they're using a like punch payphone. At least it's not rotary, but
yeah, and I think that might have something to do with
it. And
they
do talk about the cell phone, right? There is the question, like, haven't they, like, have they texted you maybe on your cell phone?
Right.
And even the way it was sort of put in there was kind of pushed in, so it was not natural that, oh no, I haven't even gotten a message. It was actually like out of the way.
Right.
So it's probably
right.
not like current, yeah. but...
No, it's current enough that... Because Rose has a boombox on her vanity.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, when was the last time you saw a boombox?
Depends. When was the last time you were downtown?
Well, that's fair.
They're coming back, man. They're coming back.
They're coming back. But it's, yeah, I mean, that's something else that was sticking out in the back of my head, too. Was, I mean, it was very pointed because obviously when everyone has cell phones, that feeling of isolation is that much harder to portray.
Mm-hmm.
So setting it a few years back, I guess, makes a bit of sense in that regard.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, you know, somebody would pull out a cell phone at some point and dial 911.
Yeah. Yeah, and then through all of this, of course, there's the Emma Roberts storyline, which
yes.
doesn't particularly intersect
no.
at any point in time. So it's just like we're following sort of two completely separate storylines.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, we know that at some like somehow they interact. Like, mm-hmm. why would they be in the same film? But
right.
yeah, you know, and we don't really learn very much about her character, Joan. We just are introduced to her as she... I mean, did she get off of a train? I don't know. But she's at a train/bus station.
Yeah.
into the bathroom, removes her hospital tag. We get, you know, the flashbacks of her time in the hospital.
Yeah.
But, like, how did she get there? Where is she going? Like, you know, what is she doing?
Yeah, I mean, that's part of it I almost got a little impatient with. It's like, mm-hmm. why are we keep going back to Joan? I don't care about Joan.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I knew it had to be leading somewhere. And I'm actually glad, once you get to the end of the movie, you see why it's mm-hmm. structured the way it is.
Yeah.
And how her story figures into it. And I like that a lot. The other thing I kept thinking about in those scenes is, like, what's James Remar's story?
Yeah, the immediate, like, I mean, I get being a good Samaritan and
yes.
like, you know what, can I give you some money to get your train ticket or can I call you a cab or can I whatever? But just to invite this young woman,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, essentially pick up a hitchhiker.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And the oddness of the relationship with his wife, too. And it's like
right.
his wife is obviously not okay with this, but
yeah.
isn't doing anything about it or saying anything about it.
Right.
It's like she's almost not even part of that storyline.
Yeah, it's curious. The wife's played by Lauren Holly, and there's pretty much one scene where she has like a monologue.
Mm-hmm.
But she was very good delivering that monologue.
Yeah.
But I think there was a lot about that couple that was sort of left unanswered and mm-hmm. Not that I necessarily mind. Like, when he gets to the story about why he picked Joan
yeah.
up and he's telling her why he picked her up, you're like, oh, okay. That
yeah.
makes a bit... But, you know, there's the scene where he comes into the hotel room to check on her and he's just kind of, like, hanging out even though she
yeah.
just came out of the shower and is like, just there in a towel.
Yes.
It's...
There are things that seem inappropriate
yes.
that do make you wonder, right?
Yes.
Like, what
yeah.
was the relationship? Between
yeah
yeah
like why did they pick her up because
yeah
I mean there was a maybe because it shows how much TV I watch which is too much but there mm-hmm. was like an episode of Criminal Minds where it was about the unsub was a couple who would pick up hitchhikers and they would you know take advantage of the situation let's
yeah.
say so
yeah.
it's so I mean that was in the back of my head too but I mean it's great to watch a movie and just sort of be, like, picking at threads. Because when I was writing notes for this while watching the movie, I was just, like, mostly writing down questions. Like, what does that mean?
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's what's going on here? and that was really fun. And I think what I want to highlight especially is the production value.
Mm-hmm.
And I did make a point of writing down the sound editor's name, Richard Harkness, and the sound designer's name, who is Alan Forey. Because this movie is just, we were joking about,
mm-hmm.
you asked, like, did you find a clip with sound?
Yeah.
And yeah, it is hard to find a clip with sound, because so much of this is just like quiet. So much is just like the sound
empty
of footsteps
space.
Shuffling down the hall, which is barely there at all when a big empty space and everything's echoing around. It's you know,
and it's winter too,
and it's
right?
winter, so
like everything. Yeah, they did a really great job of making you feel like you were alone on this big campus.
It's I don't think it can be understated, and like the music is Spartan too, almost to the point like there's one scene where something bad happens and then it's quiet and then the music starts being sewn in, and it's like jarring. It's like, no, what are you
stop
doing?
It stop,
yeah,
it. Just stop with the music.
I get it, something bad's happening. It's I'm really glad you recommended this, and I am more than happy to recommend it to others if you like. Not necessarily if you like scary movies. I mean, there were some like gore, like some kind of gore, but it's not like explicit gore.
No.
It's very sort of psycho is probably a good comparison, because it's frightening. And it gives you the creeps, but it's not necessarily explicit in terms of bloodletting and stuff. Yeah. So it's really good like that. It's purely about atmosphere. It's purely about establishing a feeling of unease and just wigging you out and making you think about, you know, when you get to the end and you sat and you think back at how it all unfolded.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a treat.
And I'm very glad that these types of movies are becoming more popular, because I mean, that's really the only place to go in horror, because we went down that, you know, torture porn sort of thing, the extreme gore, you know, where people are talking about, you know, like Cannibal Holocaust and Human Centipede, these films that are just so like gore and like terror, like just horrible things.
Yes.
Where there's really nowhere else to go there. And you know, to bring it back to the slow pace, the atmosphere, the not really understanding what's happening, I think is exactly what we need. As a person who loves horror films, I always find it frustrating when after someone watches a film, like Hereditary, for instance, I heard a lot of people say, well, it wasn't even scary. Or people saying, oh yeah, I laughed at, you know, this part. You know, at the demonic possession, I laughed at the possession. And it's like, then that doesn't make it not good. It means that you don't have the patience or you weren't invested in it.
Right.
You were waiting for something else. And I feel like the more we give people this, the more we'll bring everybody back down a little bit. Because to me, just constant shock and constant, like The Nun, we could have talked a whole lot about. I didn't see the YouTube ad. I mean, I did see it after the fact.
Yeah, yeah.
It never appeared in front of one of my YouTube clips. But the fact that the Nun, you know, it's just like, to me, that's what it takes for people to get scared now. And it's like, but that's not smart. That's not intelligent. That takes very little work. And I'm not against jump scares. I'm really not.
Right.
But it's just like, that's not horror.
But it's also a matter of character. And like the design of the Nun is what makes it so compelling. And there's nothing like that in here. And even the demonic figure you see, it's always like in shadow and it's blacked out and it's half fuzzy and like it could be anything at all.
Yeah.
But you're right. Like once, you know, you have Heather Matarazzo hanging upside down naked and a woman like literally bathing in her blood, you can't.
There's nowhere to go.
There's nowhere to go. Yeah. That was a reference to Hostel too, by the way.
Yeah. Because we haven't talked about Eli Roth enough. I think I didn't even mention his name when we were talking about the bad times at the El Royale, even though it kind of has we did talk Tarantino, but it has a little.
Well, Eli Roth is kind of a scion of Tarantino. Yeah. It counts.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's The Black Coat's Daughter, and you can find it streaming exclusively on Shudder, which is the horror movie streaming service, but you can also rent or buy it at any of your favorite VOD distributors as well, like iTunes. And we have to call it a day for end credits. And you can listen to this or other episodes of the show at our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can find us on social media on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show or on Twitter at End Credits Radio. And Candace, where can people look you up on the internet if they're brave enough?
If you're brave enough, you can Google CINN48, C-I-N-N-4-8, and you will find all of my everything everywhere. And please tune in to the Village podcast by The Bookshelf. Once a month, we talk about what's coming up at The Bookshelf and what we've read, and that should come out next week sometime.
Oh, well, there you go. I will be back on CFRU tomorrow at 5 p.m. for News and Politics and Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson or go to guelphpolitico.ca. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we will be back here next week, Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more end credits. So mark that in your calendar, you new kids. We will see you then. Thank you.